Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for tuning in today. It is good to have you with us. My name is Henrik Palmgren from the land of the Goths in the heart of Scandinavia. And this is a radio program where you can tune in when it works best for you through our website, redicecreations.com. We also have our program available on Stitcher, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and on YouTube as well. First hour, always free, sometimes both. And our full archive with both hours is available at redicemembers.com. Our guest today is Frank Salter, who's been with us two times before. He is an Australian academic and researcher at the former Max Planck Institute for Behavioral Physiology. He is a political ethologist studying political phenomena using the methods and theories of behavioral biology in addition to conventional methods. He is the author of about six books, I believe. Today our topic is going to be on eugenics, while Frank takes a very cautious approach to eugenics. When he considers who have been pushing it in the past, he has become interested in how this field is now once again emerging into our world, and at this time from a somewhat unexpected area, at least for some. We are going to discuss his article, Eugenics, Ready or Not, from the Quadrant, published there recently, about how new technologies and the market demand for safer fertility processes could be leading to a new era of this much despised and feared practice. We'll break down the various kinds of eugenics and its applications before we talk about how it can both benefit but also what it might lead to if it goes unchecked. Now, personally, I can understand why authoritarian figures have been concerned with this question, considering where we are heading right now. And despite that most people in our day and age are afraid of this practice, the improvement and betterment of mankind is a concern for all that take a long view of history and have our future as concern. Stay with us as we'll hear what Frank have to bring to the table regarding eugenics. Welcome back, Frank. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for coming on with us again.
It's a pleasure, Henry.
Always great having you with us, as I said. And you wrote another great piece in the Quadrant here called Eugenics, Ready or Not. And I wanted to bring you on and talk more about it today here. There's a lot of interesting things that you bring up in the article. And I think if there is one subject that there is a lot of confusion about, both due to, misunderstandings and misapplications, perhaps eugenics would be one of them. And I think most people generally are afraid of eugenics these days. And we'll speak a little bit more about that later. But maybe you can just clarify first for us, Frank, And detail what the word means. What is eugenics, and what does it mean?
Well, the genius who put this together was the polymath Francis Galton, an English scientist who died around the First World War but was active in the late 19th century. And he actually coined the term eugenics. Means good, and genic means breeding, so it means of good birth or good breeding. And also its opposite, dysgenic, D-Y-S, means bad, so it's bad breeding. So those two words are necessary to have an informed discussion about this, eugenics and dysgenics. Now, Galton was this polymath. He contributed to statistics and psychology. He helped invent the correlation coefficient, for example. And he found that family sizes increased as you go down the socioeconomic strata. So as people become poorer, they were having more children. This is in England, right? So it's not a racial idea. This is a population idea within an ethnic group. And he said this must be dysgenic, because if a society is a meritocracy to some extent, that is, people who work harder and smarter and are more creative acquire more wealth, and those who are the opposite acquire less wealth, then people who are having more children will tend to replace those who are having fewer. And so from the beginning, he brought in this anxiety that things are going not well, that we're sort of heading towards a cliff. And that's been an unstated but very important part of eugenics from the beginning. And it's fed by anxiety about, you know, about the future and about the direction society is going. So eugenics on the one side is a set of scientific ideas about how to overcome that and about genetics. In fact, a lot of genetics, early genetics, was researched by eugenicists. Right? So Galton made important contributions to the science of genetics from a eugenic perspective, and that's just not talked about because it's an unpopular fact. So, but it's important at this stage just to note that there is this pessimistic and anxious element to eugenics, and that is fed into what I think have been some extreme ideologies that have made use of eugenics.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, is it an ideal? Because I mean, if we take it from the what most people, I guess, feel or what they sense when they hear the word, they think about genocide. They think about, you know, suffering, or, you know, basically killing people in one way or another, even if it's a roundabout way or direct way. But is that the full extent of it? Isn't there much more to it than that?
Yeah, there's much more. Now, look, let me start by reinforcing that prejudice. If you say to someone in the street, "What have you heard of eugenics?" The common answer will be, "Ah, the Nazis."
Right.
Hitler, wasn't that Hitler and the Nazis murdering people, mass murder, the Holocaust? So it's all mixed in. And let me read something. There's an element of truth in that. So let me read this quote from Hitler. This is from Mein Kampf. He said, quote, "The state should produce images of the Lord and not monstrosities halfway between man and ape. The state must act as the guardian of a millennial future in the face of which the wishes and the selfishness of the individual must appear as nothing and submit. Eugenics over a period of only 600 years would free humanity from a great misfortune," unquote. Now notice some elements in there that actually fit that stereotype, that negative stereotype of eugenics, that the individual must submit. That individual wishes, individual liberties are nothing compared to breeding better people. So this is typical Hitlerian, harsh, authoritarian statement. So that fits the common perception of eugenics. But here's another quote, and I'll read it, and then see if listeners can guess where the quote comes from. Mm-hmm. You were meant, this is an article written to America, right? And the year is 1935. "You Americans, after taking a firm grip on your economic machinery and your culture, will apply genuine scientific methods to the problem of eugenics. Within a century, out of your melting pot of races, there will come a new breed of men, the first worthy of the name man." Now, unquote. Now, just think of how strong those words are. After only eugenics will make Americans really qualify as humans. Right? Mm. Now, this person, and I'll identify soon, this person isn't suggesting that Americans were inferior to other people. He believes it's about humans in general. Humans in general are not really what we'd like to think of as human, are they? But with eugenics, they finally will become human. This is radical, anti-humanistic stuff, right? It speaks of an arrogance. And I think those two quotes belong together.
Right.
Now, who was our mystery man? It was Leon Trotsky.
Right.
Leon Trotsky.
Yeah.
After he fled the Soviet Union, and he fled from an anti-eugenic Stalin. And here's the interesting fact no one has heard about. When the Trotsky-Lenin coup d'etat wasn't a revolution, it was a coup d'etat in just two cities. in October 1917, they instituted a eugenics institute, a eugenics foundation for breeding superior Russians or Soviet people, right? That's not known. Lenin was an enthusiast of eugenics and Trotsky too. Why? Because eugenics was part of the progressive movement. It was seen as modern. It was, you know, using modern science and technology, and we could conquer all with it. It was part of utopian socialism. So utopian socialists had no problem with eugenics, especially since being of a totalitarian frame of mind, they didn't care much about human rights, liberties, all these sort of these liberal values. So here we have a squaring of the circle, or coming of the circle back to itself. Adolf Hitler on the far right saying things very similar to Leon Trotsky on the far left.
Mm-hmm.
Why? And my interpretation is that because they both had scant regard for human rights, for human dignity, for human freedom of choice. They had a vision and they wanted to forge a new human. It also shows contempt for humans as they actually are, with all our foibles, all our weaknesses. They didn't love us very much, did they? They wanted to make us into something better. Now, there's more I can say in this line. What I'm trying to do is qualify this image of eugenics as just a Nazi, far-right, nutty thing. Hitler's policy, when Hitler came to power in 1933, he instituted eugenics. So the common understanding is correct in that regard. However, the legislation was waiting, prepared by the Weimar Republic. So when Hitler came to power, it was put on his desk, fully prepared, researched, all the arguments put in place, the legislation drawn up, and he just passed it by decree. So it wasn't passed by a parliament, it was passed by decree. That was the only difference. So what's going on here? Well, the fact is the Weimar Republic, which was sort of a combination of centre-left and more left socialist doctrines, was avidly pro-eugenic. And the Weimar Republic was very much part of a progressive Western embrace of eugenics. Sweden had a eugenics program,
yep,
which maintained into the 1970s.
That's right.
Into the 1970s. Norway, Switzerland. The list goes on. Not Britain, I'm very proud to say. Not Britain, because Britain had these traditions of individual rights. It was very more difficult to have this policy adopted in Britain. But Nazi Germany was part of a much broader thrust. But I haven't really named the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which was the United States.
Right.
Many states in the U.S. had adopted official eugenics. And some of the worst excesses of what I call authoritarian eugenics occurred in the U.S. The most famous of all was a case in which a black woman was brought before the court for sterilization. So the one method for eugenics was to sterilize people considered unfit to breed. This is, for me, as a liberal who believes in individual liberties, this is just a horror story. It went to court. And in fact, it went to the Supreme Court of the United States. Should this woman be sterilized or not? And the Supreme Court found in favor of the eugenicists, and she was sterilized.
Right.
Now, why was she sterilized? Well, it was argued that she came from, not only was she low intelligence, but her family was low intelligence, which may have been true. There's, by the way, there's counter evidence on that. She was not as stupid as made out. But whether she was stupid or not, to take someone and deem them unfit to breed, I just find is giving so much power to the state that that any right-thinking person should resist that. So far from being a Nazi ideology, this was happening before Hitler came to power, by the way. Before Hitler came to power. So this was part of the progressive movement. It actually was part of the socialist left that was promoting it, hence Lenin and Trotsky and so on. Now, it's interesting that in the United States, the states that did resist eugenics, that said no, who were they? They were the Christian southern states that had a strong Protestant or Catholic tradition, Catholic more due to immigrants in the north, but it was the church, it was the Christian church that stood against this. And it was traditions that stood against this as well, the more traditional conservative states. That runs completely counter to the stereotype, which is that, you know, eugenics is an ideology of the right. So that's our starting point. So with eugenics, for most of its history, has been an ideology of the left, okay, because it's seen as part of a progressive mix of instruments for changing society and improving it. Quite interesting.
It's a technology, right? And most technologies have been implemented in most regards, whether we like it or not. It was a way of, I mean, because just to clarify what you said, they didn't do this because they were, you know, evil and thought, haha, let's ruin people's lives. It was there's a reason that they thought they did the right thing. That's why it was implemented, correct?
Yes, and one reason that it was an ideology of the left is that it's collectivist. So what it's doing is placing the good of the population or the group ahead of the good of the individual, right? Or ahead of the rights of the individual. So collectivism can lead to policies that are revolting to a person with a modern sensibility about, you know, civil liberties and individual dignity. So once you step into that collectivist frame of mind, and it can, that, which can be legitimate, of course, if your country's being invaded, a typical rules of discourse and so on fall away when the serious war's underway, right? So the government has the right to, for example, conscript soldiers, and a whole range of things happen. Foreigners might be rounded up and put in protective custody. I mean, to protect society against them in case they're, agents and so on.
Sure.
All sorts of things happen during wars that completely abrogate individual liberties. And that's why war is generally the enemy of people who love liberty and freedom. Because the normal rules are suspended during wartime. Well, the same applies to people who embrace a collectivist ideology, whether it be Nazism or communism or socialism, that they will look at these technologies and say, oh, that seems quite useful. We could really improve society that way. Because they don't put the liberty, the rights of the individual first. So we've got two aspects to this eugenic story. We've got the science and technology, and that's a two-part article that you're referring to. The first part deals largely with the science and technology. The second part is the politics and ethics. And in the second part, which we can talk about later, I ask the question, is it ever justified for a government to take the initiative in eugenics? Is it ever justified? Because my starting position is no, it's not. So in my view, the presumption must be no. You don't have a government saying to an individual, oh, by the way, no children for you. Please report to the sterilization doctor. And then to someone else, and we want you to have eight. Report to the fertility clinic.
Right.
This is just monstrous from a progressive to liberal view, but from a traditional, from a Christian traditional point of view, from a conservative point of view. So that's the point of the second article. And but the first, I think, is fascinating in its own right. And as I hope we can now discuss the science and technology of it, of eugenics.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask you one thing before we move on here, and it's pertaining to the question of if any of the concerns are legitimate. I mean, we have to recognize that we find ourselves today in a place where nature has largely been removed from the equation. We are curing various things. We are doing various things, which is, of course, permittable, as opposed to if nature was the ruling entity, many people wouldn't survive, etc. So the question in the extension is, if modernity has taken us into a new direction, are the concerns regarding eugenics legitimate, in your view, Frank?
I think they are. I think I've been stating many of those concerns. It's a civil liberties, mainly civil liberties issue about big government, breeding being run by bureaucrats. For heaven's sake, would you trust having a bureaucrat determine how many children each person may have? I mean, it just sounds monstrous to me. So I think the concerns are completely legitimate. And we know that eugenics has been abused again and again. And so my starting position is that that authoritarian eugenics are extremely dangerous. And so it should not be attempted. But there's another issue, which is the science and technology. Now, eugenics has become a taboo word. The left has gone from being its main advocate and made a switch between 1950 and the 1970s. The left sort of realized that it had a different agenda and has turned against eugenics. The word has become a political swear word. And as with race, for example, the left has become so obsessed with deploying this word as a taboo word that it denies the science and technology. Now, this is interesting. In order to talk intelligently about eugenics, one must talk about human genetics, right? Breeding.
Yeah.
About, for example, some characteristics, the language you speak has zero heritability. Depends where you grew up. Anyone, any child brought up in any society will speak the local language without accent. Okay? So language has zero heritability. Oh, well, there's some question about that, but it's borderline frontline research. Basically, that's the mainstream view in science. Language has zero heritability. But some things, say, hair form, skin color, these sorts of things, are highly heritable, highly, highly heritable. So basically determined by genes with slight environmental effects. So the question is, what about schizophrenia, which affects 1 in 300 people, a devastating mental disease, schizophrenia? Is it genetically caused? Is it environmentally caused? Or is it a mix of both? If it's a mix, what's the proportion of genetic and environmental effects? These sorts of questions, this is standard fare in genetics, right? The left, because it has an anti-genetic orientation, right, because of its utopian goals, it wants to believe that social engineering can achieve anything. And so the left desperately wants to believe that genetics plays little or no role in so, for example, social stratification, inequality, and group differences, and gender differences, and so on. This is, in my view, is why the left has turned so vehemently against eugenics, because eugenics entails genetics. Right. So,
yeah.
To even talk about eugenics, one must use all these genetic concepts and all this massive information that has now been accumulated by geneticists over the last century. We have a wealth of knowledge now about that. But in the soft social sciences, right, cultural anthropology, political science, sociology, it's denied. They're living in a Lysenkoian world. Lysenko was the Soviet official who denied genetics and thought that you could persuade wheat to grow in winter. Actually, by the way, this was a Soviet doctrine. You could persuade crops to push their way through the snow and grow without sun in sub-zero temperatures. Yep.
Mm.
Yep. That's why millions of Russians starved, because the state believed this nonsense. So the irony is that the soft social sciences around the West today live in a Lysenkoist environment where they don't talk about genetics. Genetics has no effects, and so on. That's current now, not 2015. And I've written extensively on that about how biology was pushed out of the social sciences, resulting in the corruption of those disciplines and leaving them open to wild ideologies. So eugenics is interesting politically in this way because it fits into this pattern. So of course eugenics has to be rejected because it entails genetics. So it's interesting. There's a mix of science and technology and ethics and politics in the subjects. And the reality is this, that the science of eugenics is overwhelmingly proven because the science of genetics is overwhelmingly proven. There is, of course, utopian eugenics. So in researching these articles, I came across views, especially from the earlier part of the 20th century, where it was believed that one could do anything with eugenics. There, you know, one could achieve almost anything. There'd be super results. You'd have people, you know, like demigods, living forever and all being beautiful and all being brilliant and all the rest of it and having no disease and all the rest of it. It's not like that. That's not reality. So there's been a lot of nonsense spoken in support of eugenics. There's been a lot of nonsense spoken in support of communism and socialism, you know, that inequality will go and so on.
Frank, isn't that kind of part of when, again, as I said before, when you have a new science showing up, you remember those old information films from America coming out about how cars were going to be atomically driven and, you know, it's going to be in this, you know, flying cars and a new super age. And it seems to kind of come with whenever there's a new major discovery in one way that the anticipation kind of, trumps the reality of the situation. And it takes a while for that to kind of settle in and the reality actually finds its place eventually, right?
Exactly. For example, with electricity, I think it was Thomas Edison who said that, the way we're progressing, electricity will be so cheap that only the wealthy will burn candles.
Right? Yep.
Because only the wealthy will be able to afford candles, won't be manufactured, electricity will be free and so on. And then people came along in the 50s and said, yes, now we've got nuclear power. There's no problem. We've solved all the technical problems. We'll have nuclear generating plants with no pollution. I mean, so of course there's a utopian, unrealistic element in a lot of these technologies, but that doesn't mean that cars have not revolutionized transport and society.
Sure.
And that electricity has not revolutionized. These have had tremendous impact. So it is true that they have a big impact, but it's just not that they'll send us to the moon necessarily or to the stars or create a perfect society. So these errors don't invalidate eugenics. It just means that it's a technology for good or for ill, but it's a technology that has an effect.
So where are we with eugenics today? What is happening now? It seems like it's taking a different route, which is kept out largely out of politics, but it's coming to us through science, through the market, basically, of people being concerned for their children, correct?
Yeah, the big driver of eugenics is people concerned about genetic disease in their children, which is called negative eugenics, right? And that's generally the healthier, safer type. The other type of eugenics is called positive. And that's where a parent might say, look, there's no evidence that my future children will have schizophrenia or some disease, but I want them to be stronger. I want them to be more attractive. I want them to have more vigor. I want them to be more intelligent. And in other words, taking already healthy genes and engineering them or changing them to make them produce a, quote, better, unquote, better person. So that's called positive eugenics. Now, where we are now is in the realm of negative eugenics, but I'll come to the positive later. The door is opening for that. And where we are is that government programs of coercive eugenics basically were wiped out, were given the death knell by World War II, right? So the fact that this evil regime, you know, the Nazi Germany adopted eugenics, in the end, it took a couple of decades, but by the 1970s, finally, all those, you know, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and so on, had dismantled their eugenics programs. But what remained was genetic counseling. It's called genetic counseling. Many of the larger hospitals had a genetic counseling unit where parents could go, have blood tests, and find out if they were at risk of producing children with genetic disease. And they would advise them, well, you're clear, that's okay, no, it's good you check that, that's all right. Ah, what we've found is that you have a predisposition for early onset heart disease, or you, and so on, right? They were giving advice, and they would. One technology that was useful there was genetic testing or chromosomal testing of fetuses. So you take some amniotic fluid from the pregnant woman, and you test it, and you might say, well, this child has Down syndrome, and we recommend abortion. So eugenics has been connected to abortion for a long time, and this has led to a major ethical criticism of it from a traditionalist and especially Christian perspective, that because eugenics meant abortion in their minds, and it often did, they were opposed to it and critical of it. And we can talk about that later, but that's a concern that I share, actually. I share, especially when we're talking about fetuses with our beating heart and with feelings that recoils from pain and with a brain and so on, that's becoming human. I don't feel that way about a little sphere of cells called the blastocyte, made up of 100 cells. It has no nervous system, no brain, no feelings. I don't feel that way about that. Anyway, so let's come to that in a moment. So genetic counseling, and that went through, and there's one other aspect of that is eugenic that should be mentioned, and that is that in many places around the world, especially the United States, one had to have a marriage license before one could be married, legally married. And in that marriage test, and it continues today in many states in the United States, and one has to declare that the person one is marrying is not a sibling or a cousin. Why? Because we know there's a high chance of genetic disease when siblings marry, when siblings have children together, or uncles and nieces, or, you know, cousins, or first cousins, less so. That is a eugenic consideration. Then there's a blood test for sickle cell anemia. The African populations have relatively high rates of sickle cell anemia, which when inherited, this gene, inherited from both parents, not one, but from both parents, produces some anemia, which is really bad for health. In fact, it kills the child. So there were blood tests requirements and so on, different sorts of tests. And I suppose that's a form of traditional eugenics, negative eugenics. No? There's no attempt to breed a better person or something, or a superior person, but just to avoid disease. So that's where we were. And trundling along, so but at a very low level, and And I think that was that there have been some ethical, moral arguments against that, against the abortion component, right? No, especially against the abortion. That was the main ethical concern. And I have to say that the left had no problem with that. So the left side of politics had no problem. But it was the right, it was the Christian right, actually, that objected because of the abortion component.
Right.
So this gave rise to debates and so on, which trundled along. Basically, the left won those arguments. We've had an expanding hegemonic ideology of genetic counselling and abortion when a fetus is found to be to have problems, genetic problems, aborted and so on. So that's been the modernist trend. Notice the left taking the lead again. Then, beginning in the 1970s and developing through and rapidly developing through to today, is a new technology which is revolutionising the field, and that is in vitro fertilisation. In other words, you take an egg from a woman, you take sperm from a man, you mix them together in a test tube, hence vitro means glass. It's fertilisation in glass, in vitro fertilisation. Then once you have one or more fertilized eggs, you implant them in the woman, and through you go. Now that's for women for whom normal sex doesn't produce viable fertilizations. So more and more women now are delaying having babies. For professional reasons and so on. More and more women are working and being educated. And so IVF has become a mass industry. In Australia, it's a $500 million industry or more, $1 billion industry by now. It's big in the United States. It's big in Europe. Every industrial and post-industrial country where women are delaying childbirth, IVF is being used by women, and this is really the frontier now, because IVF, the technology, is improving. So at first, babies produced by IVF had some difficulties, right? There were some difficulties. They had some developmental problems, and those are now being overcome. For example, in China, the recent research this last year in China found that simply by freezing the woman's eggs before fertilizing in the test tube, by freezing them, giving the woman's hormones time to settle down, because when they take eggs from the woman, what they do is inject hormones into the woman so that she produces not one egg, right, and the fallopian tubes, but she produces maybe 10 or 12 or 13. That's a typical
crop. Yeah, there's some horrible drugs there too, by the way.
You give them terrible drugs, and it's just their hormones go wild.
Yeah.
Just go wild, and the ovaries are really stimulated, and you produce these eggs. If you then fertilize that, and then a month later or 2 weeks later or a week later, you implant the embryo in the woman, she's still hormonally abnormal. She's still going through these waves of change.
Oh yeah.
And so there's no wonder that there's developmental problems. And the Chinese have found that simply by freezing the eggs, waiting a year, then doing a procedure, the resulting children actually are better. They're above average in motor skills and so on, and social interactions. Their social skills are better. They seem brighter. They seem happier, better coordinated. So IVF is improving. And at the same time, there's another thing that's happening which plugs into IVF, and that is genetic engineering. So we can now, here's the procedure that's coming along. That's called pre-implantation screening. Genetic screening, pre-implantation screening. So, same thing. You harvest some eggs from the woman, fertilize them in the test tube, let those 10 or 12 embryos develop for a week till they're blastocytes. What is a blastocyte again? It's a little spherical bundle of about 100 cells. Then you pluck, under the microscope, you pluck one cell, just one. It doesn't affect the later child. It's not harmful. You pluck one cell, sequence its DNA. So sequencing, this, you see, all these technologies are coming together. You then sequence it, the entire genome of that cell. It costs only $1,000 these days. You know that the first genome to be sequenced cost $1,000,000,000 to sequence. And now we can do it in a day for $1,000.
Yep. Yep.
And it's predicted that in 5 to 10 years, we'll be doing it for $10 a scan.
Yeah.
So then they go through it and they say, okay, all right. They go to it and say, look, to the parents, look, we've got 10 here. Here are the summary of the scans of these sequences. Here's the likely phenotypic outcomes. And they could, and at present when they do this, they're looking for disease. And I think that's the healthiest, that's the safest way to go. It's negative eugenics. They're looking to make sure, you know, the child doesn't have some serious abnormality. At the simplest level, two of the, chromosomes stick together and that's Down syndrome. That's the simplest one. But in principle, they'd be able to go, okay, so this child has a certain mutation load with an emphasis on this. This one will be certain height, will have an IQ range of that, a personality of that, in principle. Because being human, everything we value in a human comes from genes, whether it be the genes themselves or the learning capacity created by the genes. So there's tremendous scope. As this technology develops, there's tremendous scope for positive eugenics, whether it is actually positive in its outcome or not, but it's called positive eugenics.
Yeah.
So this technology, and what I'm arguing in these essays is, listen, this has sort of crept up on us. We haven't actually, society hasn't actually done its thinking. We need to think this through. Where are we headed? Because this can be scary. It can also be very a benefit. Okay, of course it can be benefit, especially for parents who save their children from terrible genetic diseases. But you know, so we've got this two main ways we can go: negative eugenics and positive eugenics, and we can do so. I paint four very simple scenarios. Positive eugenics and negative eugenics, adopted by a small minority of the population or by a large majority. So there are four scenarios. And I just go through it. It's speculative. I admit that it's speculative, but I'm just trying to get the debate going. What are the likely outcomes of these scenarios? For me, the most benign is where you have the majority adopting negative eugenics, no? Just disease being prevented.
Right.
The next most dangerous, the next safest one is where a minority adopts negative eugenics, because negative eugenics are generally safer. So what would happen if a small minority adopted negative eugenics? Well, their children will be healthier, but not that much. I mean, it's only 1% of humans suffer from genetic disease. Let's not fall into the trap of utopian eugenics. It's only 1%. There'd be another effect, and that is by reducing the mutation load, the children would be slightly brighter, have more vigor, better interpersonal skills. They'd generally be healthier, you know, clearer skin and that sort of thing. The effect wouldn't be dramatic, but there would be an effect, an average effect by reducing the mutation load. And just to put that in perspective, the typical number of fresh mutations passed on by a man is 70, by a woman, it's about 13, mm-hmm. 13 to 15 new mutations that occur in that man and in that woman. So most new mutations come from men. If the man, though, is young, say he's 25, 20 or 25, he only passes on something like 20 or 25 mutations. But if he's 50, he can pass on 120 mutations. So this science has now developed to such an extent they can actually count the number of mutations being passed on by people to their children by sequencing the child, sequencing the parent, parent's genes. So to put that scenario in context, every generation, like a clock, mutations are building up. Click, 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 right? Every generation, mutations are growing. Now, what happens in the natural situation is that if the mutations become so burdensome that a child has a poor immune system, then it does.
Yeah, exactly.
Or is so afflicted, just doesn't have children. That's called natural selection.
That's right.
Or if a child is born and has such a heavy and unfortunate mutation load that it's just can't learn properly, it's dull. It's a dull child, then it might have no children. It might have an accident, or it might, in a farming community, it might be a poor farmer and just can't support so many children, starve. And it's a brutal process. Natural selection sounds so benign. It's not benign. It's the scythe. It's cutting, the scythe which cuts down the mutations that arise every generation. By the way, in every organism in the world has mutations coming in, pick each generation, just a few of them. And we have, and natural selection comes in and just brutally cuts those mutations down. Now, starting about 200 years ago in Europe, which was the first area to develop industry and modern medicine, natural mutation was relaxed.
That's right.
It's called, yeah, called relaxed natural selection. And that meant that a much higher mutation load could be tolerated because people had, for example, say the immune system was a bit weak. Well, we had medicine. We'd just give them a pill. Or what if they couldn't work very well? We had welfare. So welfare buffers it, allows more mutations to continue, and so does wealth and medical science. The result is that industrial societies accumulate a much heavier mutation load than found in, for example, hunter-gatherers.
Right. Interesting.
It also implies that evolution has greatly accelerated as wealth and technology have developed, because mutations are the stuff of evolution. Most mutations, of course, are deleterious because we are an extraordinarily complex system. An organism is extraordinarily complex. All these interrelating parts and the complementary functions and physiology and psychology and so on. So any change is likely to be deleterious, but every now and then along comes a mutation that actually improves the immune system or other part of physiology. And that then in the past would spread through the population. Why? Because the affected individual has more children, has more offspring, and so on. So the mutation is spread throughout the gene pool. So over the last 10,000 years, since the Neolithic Revolution, since farming developed in the Near East, the rate of evolution has gone up an estimated 100 times the speed at which we are evolving. Our gut, our nervous system, our personality and so on, especially, by the way, gut, because the diet changed. That was one of the big changes.
Yeah.
This is the work by geneticist Henry Harpending and Greg Cochran in the United States. A great book, by the way, called the 10,000 year explosion, something like that. It's just look up Harpending and Cochran on that. So So accelerated evolution, but at the same time, in the last 200 years in the West, we've had growing mutation load. So that's the context. In that context, if a small minority of people adopt negative eugenics, their children will be generally healthier. Not spectacularly so, but just, you know, it hasn't been measured, but it would be, they would be somewhat healthier, somewhat brighter, have more vigor, for example, fewer diseases and so on. And of course they also wouldn't have those debilitating genetic diseases, things that are so badly caused, like, you know, cystic fibrosis and different syndromes, schizophrenia and so on. So, if a small number of people, and they probably would be wealthy, so there's a class element here, they probably would be wealthy, and this would be another privilege. Not only would they get to send their children to expensive schools with the old school tie and therefore economic advantages in the future, but the children would be actually slightly stronger, smarter, healthier, more vigorous, more attractive. But because it's a slight effect, I don't think this is the worst outcome of eugenics. It's something to keep an eye on, but I don't think that form of privilege, that form of inequality would be catastrophic. But we're getting there, because I'll move on now to the third scenario. The third scenario I consider is where, again, now we're on to positive eugenics, right? Inherently more dangerous. So socially dangerous. Now, imagine a small elite, wealthy elite, adopt positive eugenics. I think, well, look, we're doing the pre-implantation screening anyway. Why, instead of merely selecting embryos that don't have genetic disease, let's choose one that, you know, because every sexual reproduction is like throwing dice. Every family, the children have significant range of intelligence and personalities and vigor and immune systems and so on. There's a spread within a family, among siblings. Significant. Like, I think there's an average IQ difference between siblings of 10 IQ points.
Hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong. That's from memory.
Right.
So imagine if wealthy people could do that, or even worse, if they could say, I'd actually like to have this characteristic. Could we get that in there from somewhere? Could we just do some genetic engineering? You know, so you do the sequencing of an embryo, and then you'd go in and you'd actually snip out a little sequence and paste in. It's called gene editing. It's called gene editing, just like one edits a computer program. Well, the time is coming when parents will be able, through using, you know, doctors and scientists, they'll be able to edit their children's genes. We have to get used to the idea. Gene editing is on the horizon. It's now, it's actually being done with the non-human species.
Yeah.
Gene editing.
That's right.
Okay. So now we're talking real spectacular results. So what would their children be like? Well, not only would they send them to better schools and with the old school tie effect and all that, but their children would be probably taller, significantly more attractive, have a significantly higher intelligence than the average child, stronger immune system, more competitive personality, they'd be happier people with driven for success and so on. Okay? I can imagine this. What that would mean is that their children would not regress to the mean, which has happened all through history and prehistory, that people, that our elites had children who were pretty ordinary, actually, or more ordinary than their parents. So typically within three generations, a dynasty will fade away. At least in meritocratic societies, aristocrats in feudal societies got to solve that problem by just giving themselves titles and having legal rights to to, you know, monopolize the local castle and the land and own the serfs and so on. But I mean in competitive societies where you can win wealth or lose wealth depending on your ability and the work you do. Now, in those sorts of societies, this would be a radical departure from what's happened. Instead of the elite circulating, you know, talented people coming up from below, from humble backgrounds, but they've just got the, you know, the moolah. They can work, they're bright, they're ambitious and so on. And on the contrary, people from the children of the wealthy actually being dull or being lazy or being unhealthy or you're having and so on, then sinking. So if circulation of elites taking place, you would have a rigidification of class. Extremely dangerous from a number of perspectives, which we can go into. Extremely dangerous. It would mean that the elite would be able to perpetuate their status down the generations. It would be a dynasty. It would be a dynastic, a caste, a superior caste. And just to clarify, this is a particular scenario where a small minority of people, they'd probably be wealthy people, adopt positive eugenics and the rest don't. Okay?
Yeah.
And now we're talking serious difference. I mean, it could be an IQ difference of 30 IQ points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They would dominate the creative and artistic fields. They dominate wealth creation and so on. Now, we have a model of this already. We have actual life modeling of this, not quite as extreme to look at, and that's a sociological phenomenon called middleman ethnic minorities. And there's a substantial literature on this. And they're not necessarily brighter than the local population, but they're more knowledgeable. So they have special knowledge. One example is the guild system developed in Europe, especially in Germany. So the German diaspora, for example, in Romania and Bulgaria and southern Russia and Poland and Ukraine and so on, they had the scattered German population. And they would have different guilds. They'd have gold working, they'd have watchmaking, they'd have the different special artisan skills sets. And these were passed on within guilds. And what a guild means is that you don't just give the information away, you pass it on down your family or to a bounded community. And those bounds, when you have mixed populations, are often ethnic. So the boundary is often ethnic. And so we have numerous examples of ethnic middleman minorities, causing all sorts of sociological and class strains by mimicking what I'm talking about with positive eugenics.
Right.
Okay, so the natives just couldn't compete. Look, just to cite some statistics, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, the Chinese ethnic Chinese are about 1% of the population in Indonesia. They control 70% of the corporate economy. 70%, 1% of the population.
Mm.
They're so successful, they're endogamous. So these groups are typically endogamous. So they pass on the skills within an ethnic group. Endogamous means marrying within the ethnic group. There are numerous such groups. Indians in Africa, for example, because of the British Empire. Shuffle people around, workers around. So an Indian population grew up in China, developed in Africa, and had this middleman endogamous, very successful at business profile. Armenians Ottoman Empire, for example, Jews in medieval Europe, for example. So it's a pattern that's recurred. So we have something to go on, some examples, and it's not good. It's not good for social harmony, social cohesion. It's not good if one wants to avoid social conflict, because there's repeated problems between these groups. And I think something very similar would happen if a small minority adopted positive eugenics. That's the one that I come down on like a ton of bricks, and I say that should be regulated. That's where the government should step in and say, we're going to, you know, this has to be closely looked at and regulated, because it wouldn't take long, and you would have a caste with such advantages, tremendous advantages, as I described. Now, one way of softening that effect, and that's, I think, preventing most of the negative effects, would be for the government to say, all right, we've got two ways to go. One is to ban positive eugenics. We just ban positive eugenics. The other is to say, look, if we can't beat them, let's join them. So what we'll do is we'll universalize positive eugenics, or you know, the best tested elements of it, and we'll make it part of the public health system, so that there won't be a matter of privilege and inequality. Everyone will have advantage. Everyone will have access. Or you could combine the two. You could say, look, a lot of this outlandish experimentation that's taken place, we ban. Like some idiot who wants a child with two heads. Some person who wants a child that's proofed against frostbite by putting, say, salmon genes in. By the way, they do some crops.
Potatoes.
I'm not making this stuff up.
No, I know.
They'll put in fish genes into some plants to make them more proof, safe against frost damage.
Yep.
But imagine someone's, I'd quite like my child to do deep sea diving. Why don't we get the child's gills? What's this, gills? And so I think you simply ban that. You do everything you can to ban it, and do so by international treaty. So there's no option for the person to simply go overseas and.
Well, I mean, those kinds of scenarios, Frank, is like part of some of the more dystopian movies. You know, you've seen that despite them banning it, it's still kind of lingers on among a black market, if you will, and that the experimentation goes on nonetheless, despite the banning of it, of course. And some even speculate that it's already beginning to happen. You know,
I wouldn't be surprised, but it's going to be happening more and more as the technology becomes more available.
Yep.
to doctors of a lower or with fewer resources. It's called procreative tourism. The word has already been coined, procreative tourism. And in my article, I cite an example in Italy in 2000, and when was it, 2005, I think, where a woman wanted to have an abortion, an early stage abortion, because she had this problem with cystic fibrosis, and she'd had two abortions already. She didn't believe in abortion. She just didn't want a child with cystic fibrosis. And the court said, no, you may not. And the doctor, her genetic advisor, who was advising her on this, gave an interview in which he said, look, many wealthy people simply just snub the court, just go overseas and have it done overseas. Find a country where the regulations are more lax, and have it done overseas. It's called procreative tourism. Now, I think this is going to make it difficult to prevent some bad practices in positive eugenics. But look, I think most humans have common sense and they're humane. They're not going to be creating too many children with two heads just for the fun of it.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
But I think this is something that needs to be looked at closely. We need international treaties to restrict that. However, the other approach is also, I think, likely to be taken, which is that eugenics will be seen as so beneficial and so such an advantage, it'll yield such advantages for the children that everyone will want it, almost everyone. Of course, there'll be some people for ethical reasons or for ignorance, parents who just don't care, who just want to keep reproducing in a normal way. But I think a lot of people will want that. And if it were made part of the public health system, especially negative eugenics, the safer alternative, that I think would nullify a lot of these dire sociological scenarios, you know, where you have dramatic inequality. So I think that's the way to go. And look, but again, we're going to have this problem with regulating it. We have to face it that the technology is becoming more and more accessible, and that will include in the future, perhaps in 100 years, gene editing, just editing the genes of your children. And I don't have a solution to that. I'm just raising the issue.
Sure, sure, yeah.
I don't have any panacea to offer. But it has scary potential, but also has, yeah. It could be a golden age. There's quite a bit of suffering that is experienced by people due to, genetic disease and just not quick enough, just not being able to learn technology fast enough to get a job and have a meaningful, happy life.
Well, I view it from a couple of different angles. One is, of course, this kind of emerging field, I think, where the kind of positive eugenics you're talking about merges with transhumanism of basically trying to take the human species into a new direction. And there's a good amount of people, the likes of Ray Kurzweil and a number of others, billionaires, who are looking into technologies of both merging with machines, with computer brain interfaces, but they're also looking at the genetics of it. And I think initially, how much we jump and scream and whatever we do with that, it is going to be investigated and applied by those who have the financial means to do so, you know?
Mm, yes, I agree. It's a bit like space flight, you know, it's becoming privatized.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, once only a superpower could do it, but now a billionaire can put himself up in space.
Exactly. Well, and the other side of this, Frank, I wanted to just briefly touch upon before we take a break here and continue with the second here later. But it's related to, of course, the flip side to that. We spoke a little bit about it earlier, but let's just talk a little bit about it. That, you know, are we passing, as things currently stand, are we passing down bad traits? Is there legitimacy in being worried that humanity on a whole is degrading? We have the work of people like Richard Lynn, for example, who are talking about IQ levels worldwide actually dropping, intelligence going down, all these genetic diseases are continuing to pass on. And some people have are very worried for the future. They're worried in saying if we continue on this path without doing anything, it is going to be very detrimental for us in the future, right?
Yes, I think it's basically true. And the only remaining question is, to what extent is it true? Is it an imminent catastrophe or something less? And I think it's something less. I think we should not be scared into giving away our liberties, handing our governments extraordinary powers over our lives, extraordinary powers to discriminate among our rights to procreate and marry, or at least, marry and have children. So, yes, I think the science... Look, there have been a number of brilliant geneticists who've been eugenic in that sense. R.A. Fisher, for example, the great inventor of neo-Darwinism, where he combined Mendelian genetics and Darwin's ideas. Of course, Charles Darwin invented his ideas, had his ideas before the gene had been discovered, before modern genetics were discovered. So in the 1930s, R.A. Fisher put this together, and he argued that civilization was unsustainable
without eugenics. In the long run, obviously in the short run it is sustainable.
Right. Yep.
Because mutations would accumulate. Why? Because of the greater wealth. Because most people could have children that survived. Well, in the past, you had this brutal process of natural selection. And then we had someone, perhaps the greatest geneticist of the 20th century, Bill Hamilton, William Hamilton, who argued something similar. He said, I think Fisher got it right. We're going to have to make a choice. If we don't adopt some type of eugenics, at least negative eugenics, if we don't do that, the mutation load will grow and grow and grow until we crash and burn.
Exactly, yeah.
So either nature will cut down the mutation load, or we cut down the mutation load using a more humane process. Now, where I differ with these gentlemen is that they weren't political scientists. They weren't people of the far right or the far left, by the way, but they were scientists primarily. And I just think they didn't put enough thought into the political consequences. If one hands across to the government the right to determine who breeds and who does not breed, that's the end of the sort of society that I want to live in. I just find that extraordinary, becoming like an ant society. Hamilton actually, in a more general way, talked about that. He said, do we want to live like social insects, you know, where every move is regulated, rule for everything, you can breed, you can't breed, and so on? Or do we want to be free breeding individuals? And maybe it's romantic. I share his view. He wanted us to remain free breeding individuals, people with the liberty to make choices, to fail.
Right.
The freedom to fail. The freedom to succeed. Which entails some inequality. You can't have liberty without having some inequality. That's one of the costs of it.
Of course, yeah.
But
would that, let me ask you, Frank, would that also, in your view, mean that others then that did try to, well, I shouldn't use the word break away, but they wanted to have a different approach, that they also should be prevented by other means to do so, meaning that they wouldn't have the personal choice to apply eugenics in the way they wanted to?
Well, I think the presumption should be one of liberty, one of freedom. So people should be able to if they want to, for example, edit their children's genes to avoid genetic disease and so on, and disability, they should be able to do that. Where it gets complicated is where they want to try some wild experimentation, right? Look, this is not unrealistic already. We have every year, there's some cases down here in Australia, we have a small population, 24 million people, but even here we have parents who starved a child to death because of some fasting ideology, because of some quirky sort of flat earth belief that you can purify a child by giving it only water for 6 months. Just last week or the week before, the child died through malnutrition in Australia, one of the wealthiest countries in the world. So some people will make crazy choices. And if it brings them misery, that's their choice, I suppose. But if it brings misery to their children by putting genes into them that traps the child, just traps the person, every cell in their body carries that gene. They can't avoid it. That's something I think should actually be regulated. In that case, I'm a socialist. I want it regulated. I want it down a ton of bricks. The example I gave was a small minority adopting radical positive eugenics and producing super kids. One geneticist talking about this called them demigods. Do we want demigods walking around just out competing us at every turn? We're out where your children and my children have no chance of competing. And you know, I think we're willing to tolerate big differences in wealth and so on because there's the assumption that it's not permanent. And many wealthy people earned it. Of course, they earned what they have. So we sort of grudgingly or non-grudgingly say, fine. Actually, wealth overall is being boosted in this way. And as a result, their children go to better schools. Yes, we know there's some privilege and inequality resulting, but it sort of all comes out in the wash. Not with positive eugenics. Not with positive eugenics. It's a different matter. So I think we can't avoid regulation. But I think what's more important is that these matters be put on the table and discussed. I'm just giving these are just my opinions. Let's put it out there, and we need the scenarios explained, what the technology can do, what it could do, where this could lead. Right? There are misconceptions. They need to be cleared up. It needs to be brought to people's attention. And we've got time to do it. The technology is not there yet for these really radical experimentations, but it's coming, and it's coming rapidly.
Yes, it is. And yeah, just to harken back to something you mentioned earlier about W.D. Hamilton or Bill Hamilton, that he stated that when misery resulting from mutations grow too great to bear, you begin, by the way, with this early in your article. Let me start over there. When misery resulting from mutations grows too great to bear for medical, economic, or humanitarian reasons, the load will be reduced either naturally or artificially, painfully through elevated rates of mortality or painlessly through eugenics. And I think the interesting point with that is that no matter what we try to do, Frank, we can't really escape nature. It will find us sooner or later, and in one way or another, we will have to deal with things that we have put off for a time. And that's kind of what I take away from it all at the end, that we can apply these different methods, we can do all these different things, but eventually it will find us, and we will... Well, I hate to say it, but it's something which is causing pain, and it's just a matter of in which way do we want to do that? Do we want to be smart about it and think about this before it actually happens, or are we just going to go ahead as we are right now and think that, well, whatever, you know, future generations will deal with that problem later, right? That's kind of where we stand after all has been said and done.
We do, but there's one difference. You could put that question to at the governmental level or at the individual level. And what I'm saying is the reality is that a mass market is developing. That's why I title my article, Eugenics Ready or Not. It's happening.
Yep.
It's happening. A mass market is developing. We're at the point of liftoff now already where fertility clinics are offering genetic screening. So when you do IVF with them, come to us because we'll offer genetic screening to get rid of those mutations. So it's eugenics ready or not. Now that question could be put to government or it could be put to the individual. The individual can ignore it or the individual can protect her child from these problems. And I want it left at the individual level for as long as possible. I'm quite happy, given that this is inevitable with rising science and technology, given that eugenics is inevitable one way or the other, or alternatively mass die-offs due to natural selection, I'm happy with the way it's developing so far as a voluntary mass market coming from underneath, coming from the citizen, demanding services, but not demanding that, not wanting to be controlled and dictated to by government, but wanting to save, distress in the child. So that seems to me to be actually the healthiest of possible outcomes, what we have now. I am wary about governments answering that question, saying yes, we need to take it, we need to take the initiative, and that's a topic for our next talk when we discuss the best way politically to structure this. Is it ever legitimate for a government to take the initiative in eugenics? And if so, under what circumstances? And this has not been well enough discussed, and I've found a number of eugenic schemes, but I discussed two in my article, and we could talk about that next.
Yep, let's definitely do that. Much more to get into here, but let's just kind of give out some of the details where people can find your work, Frank. You have, of course, a number of books out there. Some of them is called On Genetic Interests. You also have Ethnic Conflict and Indoctrination, a number of other ones. Give us some of the websites where people can go to find your work, Frank.
Well, the easiest way, you just go to Amazon.com and type in my name and you'll have a list of my books. I have a list of books neatly in Amazon. One can also go to Quadrant. That's the Australian magazine, quadrant.com.au, I think it is, and search there. And I have a number of articles over recent years, beginning in 2010. So I have a number of articles, 2010, 12, 13, 14, and articles this year on eugenics. So those can be viewed. And you can also go to my website. My website lists actually all my publications. That's socialtechnologies.com.au, socialtechnologies, plural, .com.au. There's a page there with my publications.
All right, very good. We'll have some of the book links up, of course, and the links to the websites mentioned here as well. All right, well, thank you, Frank. We'll take a short break here, right here, and then we'll pick up in the second hour. So stay with us for more. We'll be right back. second hour, it gets even more interesting as we put what we've learned into perspective to hear more about who is pushing eugenics in our modern egalitarian and democratic society. Perhaps a bit unexpected, as university professors are seeking to alter and change human nature with the application of eugenics. And wait until you hear not only who is pushing it from what political angle, but also how they are seeking to change mankind with it, and especially the man and the woman of Western civilization is of particular concern to these people we are talking about. We discuss more about what this field could develop into and what could happen if a runaway improvement or application occurs from the current elite, and if they will use all their resources and countless billions to separate themselves from what it means to be human. There are prospects now of merging with machines and computers, of people going into the transhuman field. And this is a reality not considered by many, but it is starting to emerge now, like it or not. We'll get Frank's take on this and much more in the second hour as we continue to talk more about eugenics, both the upside and also the flip side of that. So please join us at redicemembers.com for much more. Subscribe and tune in. You can listen when it pleases you, stream or download from the website, or use our members RSS podcast feeds with a podcast app on a mobile device or a feed reader on your computer to get the latest shows in full right to you. And keep in mind, we are a 100% independent radio program, and we do value the truth above all else, and that you will get the story that the mainstream media never gives you on all the things you're not supposed to know about. We have more coming, by the way, folks, with Victoria Clark, Eric Hunt, Angelo John Gage, Jess Turner, Eric Kallstrom, Stephen McNallan, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and more after that. Well, stay tuned, and we'll be right back in the second hour. Thank you so much for listening.